From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the chaos in Sierra Leone. We'll talk with Joe Opala, an American anthropologist who lived and taught in Sierra Leone for over two decades and was active in the pro-democracy movement. He'll tell us what it was like to live in a country where the government had collapsed and banditry and terrorism filled the void. Then we'll call Sierra Leone and talk with Zineb Bangoura about the situation there now. She's a leader of the pro-democracy and human rights movements in her country. We'll also hear from Susan Rice, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs in the U.S. State Department. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sierra Leone is in chaos. The country is an example of what can go wrong when a government that is corrupt and inept collapses, leaving a void for terrorist militias to unleash a campaign of murder and mayhem. Sierra Leone is also an example of the tough choices left to the international community. Last summer, diplomats from the U.S., Britain, the U.N., and several African nations brokered a peace agreement in Lomé, Togo, that created a power-sharing deal between Sierra Leone's president, President Kabah, who was elected in a groundbreaking democratic election in 1996, and Fode Sanko, the leader of a group of terrorists and bandits known as the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front. The agreement also granted the RUF amnesty and made Sanko vice president of Sierra Leone. This was controversial in Sierra Leone because the RUF had tried to terrorize the population into submission by amputating the arms and legs of thousands of people. Now Sanko's forces are being held responsible for the capture of about 500 UN peacekeepers. About half of them have been freed. Last week, after 9 days in hiding, Sanko himself was captured by pro-government soldiers. He's being held in custody. The UN Secretary General is proposing sending in more peacekeeping troops. Nigeria had led a force from West African countries trying to stop the atrocities. They pulled out and are considering re-entering if they have sufficient financial backing from the West. My guest, Joe Opala, is an American anthropologist who lived and taught in Sierra Leone for about 20 years and became active in the pro-democracy movement. He was one of the last Westerners to leave the country during the 1997 coup. He currently teaches at James Madison University in Virginia. We spoke yesterday. Opala says the situation in Sierra Leone has been misinterpreted by the international community as a civil war, when the actual problem is the total collapse of the government.
If you look at the situation on the ground, what you find is that through years and years of official corruption, the state not only disintegrated, it literally ate itself alive. For a long period, 20 years or more, the job of a cabinet minister was to sell off all the resources of his ministry and to sell off any foreign aid that might have been channeled through his ministry, and then pass the lion's share of the money up to the president, but keep a substantial bit yourself. So after a few years of this, government ministries simply ceased to function. And there are ministries I could take you to now in Freetown in which no useful business has been conducted for 10 years or more. You'll go into a government office and find that the secretaries sold off the typewriters and the filing cabinets long ago because they weren't paid. Their civil service salaries didn't come. And so government lost not only its ability to rule, it also, of course, lost its authority and its credibility among the people. In fact, Sierra Leoneans hold the entire political class in the utmost contempt. What's clear to every Sierra Leonean, from illiterate people on up, is that The RUF, the rebels, are not a political faction of any sort. They're simply bandits. And, you know, when a government stops functioning, when there is no police power, no effective police power, obviously, I mean, it's logical, isn't it, that bandits and criminals are going to come out of the woodwork and they'll become bolder and bolder every day that they're not stopped from doing what they're doing.
When you say that banditry took over in the absence of a real state, in the absence of real government, Give us some examples of how it grew early on. Fode Sanko is the leader of the rebel group, the Revolutionary United Front, the RUF. What were some of the early banditry that this group was responsible for, and how did it kind of step into this void left during the collapse of the state?
Well, this so-called rebel war began in 1991. And at that point, Fode Sanko and his rebels crossed the border from Liberia into Sierra Leone. And they began doing the atrocities that they're still doing, but they were on the margins. They were way out on quite some distance from the capital and on literally on the edges of the country. And almost like eating an apple, they began to come in from those edges closer and closer into the core and ultimately have attacked now the capital city twice. But this didn't happen overnight. It's taken 9 years for this process to develop. And I guess from my point of view, what's so agonizing about watching this is that it was all so easily dealt with. The international community up to this very moment has not really understood the problem. And what I have been forced to watch, what Sierra Leoneans have been forced to watch these last 9 years, is the international doctor making the wrong diagnosis and then constantly giving the wrong treatment. And so the country just gets sicker and sicker.
So you're saying the diagnosis was civil war instead of collapse of the state, therefore the medicine was wrong. What would the medicine have been for a collapsed state as opposed to a civil war?
Again, what's so agonizing about this is that the medicine really is very, very simple. With a civil war, what you do, obviously, is you bring the parties together when you have legitimate factions that represent religious interest groups or regional interest groups or different ideologies or different tribal affiliations. You bring them together. You have some sort of useful negotiation with a third party, and then you accommodate everyone so that everybody's got a share in the power. But if you do that with a collapsed state, you'll only make matters worse. You can't bring bandits into the central government and expect any good to come out of it. What you should do in a situation of state collapse is, first of all, forget about accommodating the bandits. The issue here is that the institutions of government are gone. And you need a very fulsome international presence to come into the capital city and into the provinces and literally retrain the bureaucrats in how to run their ministries. And you need also, of course, to be there for some period of time so that an election can take place and so that a new political elite that has not been corrupted by these long years of corruption can then begin to have their chance to rule the country.
That could be seen as very patronizing, where, you know, like, say, the West steps in and says, no, we'll show you how democracy is done. So first we'll give you lessons, and then we'll let you try again.
Well, I can understand why people in the Western world would see it that way, but they're not understanding the situation, and they're not empathizing with people who have had to live through years and years of no effective police power, of just being naked. My last 5 years in Sierra Leone, I slept with a loaded revolver next to my bed, and most of my friends did as well.
What were you expecting?
When there's no police. The police won't come. You'll call them, they won't come. You'll call them and tell them that they've killed your wife and they're raping your daughter and they're looting your house. And if you're lucky enough to have a functioning phone, they'll say, well, we don't have any gasoline for our vehicles, so we can't come. And maybe if you're fortunate enough, you can negotiate a bribe on the phone and they will come. But people who have lived in that sort of situation for years on end, I can tell you, if an international group were to come in like that and manhandle, quite frankly, the political elite, they would be singing Hosanna in the streets. What Sierra Leoneans don't understand is why the international community does not come in and do that very thing.
Tell us a little bit more about what it was like for you when you lived in Sierra Leone to live in a place that had no real functioning government, where the state had collapsed.
It was a gradual process. I guess my first really serious awakening to the situation from a personal point of view was when three soldiers, each carrying AK-47s, burst into my house in the middle of the night, tied me up, and a young American graduate student who was visiting me from the States tied us both up, dragged us into the back bedroom on our bellies, looted the house. It was very clear from what their speech that they were stoned on something much more than just marijuana, probably cocaine or heroin. And after looting everything, they stood over our bodies there on the floor and debated among themselves whether or not to kill us before they left. They finally decided just to leave us. None of my neighbors would come close. They had tied up my watchman, who managed to escape and go into the village and try to call for help, but of course no one came. And it was not until the next morning in broad daylight when the whole village came to see what happened. I'm sure they were quite prepared to take what was left of my belongings had they found me dead there. Well, that's the effect of terror.
And who were the people who tied you up and threatened to kill you?
They were three Army soldiers, and the very next day I went to see the Army commander for that particular area. He was very kind. He ushered me into his office. When I explained the situation, he locked his office door, and he listened to me, and he said, Joe, he said, you know, this is not the Army I joined, and I pray to God that when I retire, this will not be the Army that Sierra Leone has. He said, I'm terribly sorry, but there's absolutely nothing I can do for you, because if I attempted to discipline these soldiers who did this to you, they would kill me. And what would that accomplish?
So the leaders of the military had no authority within the military.
What's hard, I think, for Americans to understand, I mean, in many respects, we live in the most successful government that has ever been created, and government permeates every part of our lives in this country. So it's hard for us to imagine a situation of true chaos. It's not just the Army. Every single institution of government and most institutions of civil society have been totally corrupted over a period of time. And any semblance of professionalism in government ministries, in the mass media, in the Bank of Sierra Leone, in the civil service, in the police, all vestiges of professionalism died long ago.
My guest is Joe Opala, an American anthropologist who lived and taught in Sierra Leone for close to 20 years. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Opala, an American anthropologist who lived in Sierra Leone for close to 20 years and became active in the pro-democracy movement. Now, your point about Fode Sanko, the head of the rebel group or the terrorist group, the RUF, your point about him is that he's not a political leader. He's a bandit who has organized a militia of bandits. Does he have no political agenda at all? What is his agenda?
He's actually mad. I mean, he's clearly insane. He is a psychopath. And if you listen, occasionally I've been given recordings of him haranguing his so-called troops. And I'm listening in the local language, and I can't make any sense out of it whatsoever. It's just babbling. I think probably the best comparison to him is Charlie Manson. If you know, Charlie Manson was a lunatic, but had a certain amount of charisma. He dragged young people disoriented at a time of social upheaval in this country, dragged them to him. He gave them drugs, and he sent them out on a lunatic mission to murder people. And that's precisely what Fode Sanko is about, except writ very, very much larger. Instead of just killing a few people, Sanko is responsible for the deaths of perhaps 50,000 people and many, many rapes and mutilations.
How does he recruit people?
He and his people would go into a village. They don't give you a chance to join, and you can see from that they have no real political agenda. What they typically would do would take the paramount chief, the man of authority locally, murder him, but torture him in front of his people. And then they would take the young boys, the adolescent boys, they would inject them with heroin or cocaine, and they would force them in front of the entire village to shoot their parents and maybe cut off your mother's head, this sort of thing. And by the time they take these boys away, they'll tell them, you know, of course you're never going to be able to go home. Your own people will hate you now. One of the things, though, that has not as much as needed gotten into the international media is what they do to the adolescent girls. They also kidnap them, and they treat them as sexual slaves. They essentially rape them to death. All the women in the situation die unless they find some way to escape. I've done a number of pro bono depositions for these girls who managed, a few of them have actually managed to make their way over here. And I've read their accounts, I've talked with them on the phone, and I've read the doctor's reports as to what's happened to them. This is hideous beyond belief, and it's on a scale much, much larger than the horrible mass rapes that we read about in the former Yugoslavia.
Who was Vode Senko before he became the head of the RUF, before he became this chief terrorist?
He was a cashiered army corporal. He had been a very minor figure in a failed military coup back in the 1970s and was imprisoned. He was actually an army photographer at that time. He was a small fish in that particular attempted coup. He spent a few years in prison, and then he left Sierra Leone and went into exile into Liberia. We understand that in Liberia he was contacted by some of Gaddafi's agents, that he went at least for a year or so to Libya for guerrilla training. I think during that period in Liberia as well, various disgruntled young Sierra Leoneans, especially Sierra Leoneans with college degrees who were angry at the corruption in government, they went down there and actually tried to tutor him in some sort of revolutionary philosophy. But it didn't take. I think Fode has been a psychopath for a very long time. He is, I mean, to put it simply, he's crazy.
The international community brokered a peace plan in Sierra Leone. It was a power-sharing plan in which Fode Senko, the head of the terrorist group, the RUF, became part of power-sharing. He became a vice president and commissioner of diamond resources, and diamonds are the country's main source of wealth. What's he done with the diamonds, and did he have any connection to the diamonds in Sierra Leone before he got this position?
Well, the RUF has always funded itself through digging diamonds, through illicit diamond mining. And so this was a sweetheart deal for Senko. I'm sure that offering him that position was an important inducement for him, coming in, making his deal with the international community at that point. And yes, of course, he's remained very much involved in the diamond trade. This is what has fueled the war to a large extent. This is what paid for all those weapons.
Diamonds. How can a country so rich in resources like Sierra Leone, which has all these diamonds, be so poor? I mean, I think it's the poorest country in the world.
By many indexes, various World Bank, IMF, United Nations, they occasionally release these lists of the poorest nations in the world, and Sierra Leone is always either on the bottom or two or three steps from the bottom. It, in fact, is, as you're implying, it's an extremely rich country, really. It's got diamonds, it's got gold, it's got huge quantities of iron ore and bauxite. It has unlimited rainfall each year, and so it's tremendous for rice and various types of agriculture. Its offshore fishing is extremely valuable. Until I went to Sierra Leone, I'd never seen a shrimp a foot long, but that's fairly common in Sierra Leone. What happened is what we've been talking about, state collapse. Over a period of time, Sierra Leone's leaders destroyed their own governments and took everything that wasn't nailed down. And so the people got poorer and poorer as time went on, and we finally reached a point in which government had so destroyed itself that it had ceased to function.
How would you compare the UN peacekeeping forces with the peacekeeping forces from West Africa, which is called ECOMOG? That's the name of the multinational West African peacekeeping force that also has had many troops in Sierra Leone.
Well, one of my frustrations has been noting that the American press will often say that the intervention by the West African forces was a failure. It actually was not a failure at all. There's an organization called ECOWAS, which is a trade union of 16 African nations. They sent in a military intervention force, peacekeeping force, made up largely of Nigerian troops, and that's ECOMOG. And the Nigerians just did a tremendous job over a period of years fighting the rebels. They took a lot of casualties, and Sierra Leoneans have great respect for the ECOMOG Nigerian forces. The problem was that year after year, the African governments pleaded with the United States and Britain and other powers for logistical support, and they never got it. The only thing they got was just crumbs off the table. And so ECOMOG could have defeated the RUF. The problem was that at various times they had no trucks or they had no gasoline, they had no spare parts, they had no field radios. But they were a disciplined force, and on the occasions that they did have the logistical support they needed, they really tore the rebels up, and everyone knows that. What happened, unfortunately, is that the Clinton administration pulled the plug on them. As late as 1998, they gave them $4 million for the entire year when the Nigerians alone were spending over $300 million, a developing country. Because the Clinton administration didn't want to continue supporting this operation, they pulled the plug and announced that the military intervention was a failure. What was a failure was the international community's unwillingness to back that force. Now we see the Nigerians, the Sierra Leoneans, crying out for a return of the Nigerian troops. The Nigerians have agreed, and now, of course, the Clinton administration is keen on showing that it does have some funds that it can provide for this group. All of this, none of this needed to happen. All of this was avoidable. As far as the UN troops are concerned, they really aren't soldiers. They're there more or less as a kind of symbol. And, of course, they never should have been sent there in the first place at the time that they were sent. Many, many of us told the international community that the power-sharing agreement was going to explode in our faces. No one listened. And, unfortunately, those UN peacekeepers had to pay the price for the international community's ignorance.
You left Sierra Leone in 1997 very reluctantly. You were one of the last Westerners to leave the country after the coup. I think from what you told us the last time you were on the show, you doubted you'd be alive if you stayed behind. Would you like to return to Sierra Leone sometime?
Definitely. You know, I went back last summer. I was there for the month of June during a very tense period. And I loved it. In fact, when I arrived at the airport, to my surprise and delight, every single official got up off his bench and came over and hugged me and said, "Welcome home." People wanted to know what I'd been doing. There was some news had gotten back about our political efforts on behalf of Sierra Leone over here. And so everyone wanted to talk to me. I think I was on TV or radio or had a newspaper interview almost every day, all the 30 days I was there. I cried, of course, the last day when I had to leave. It was very hard leaving. But yes, I hope sometime to be able to go back and live there. I think it would be reasonably safe for me to go back now. The problem is that the decisions for poor Sierra Leone are being made in Washington and in New York. And I think if I were to leave and go back now, I would not be able to do as much for the country as I can from over here. What I've also found is that due to all the chaos in Sierra Leone, there is now a wonderful class of young professional class Sierra Leoneans in their late 20s and early 30s who are flexible enough and young enough to understand the way the system works here in the United States. And they've made wonderful allies. And we've gone door to door in Congress at times with these people. And I'm tremendously proud of them as well and what they're doing for their country.
Joe Opala, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Joe Opala is an anthropologist who lived in Sierra Leone for about 20 years. He now teaches at James Madison University in Virginia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation about Sierra Leone with a phone call to Zainab Bangora in Freetown. She's a leader of the pro-democracy movement. And we'll hear from Susan Rice, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs in the U.S. State Department. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Zainab Bangora is one of the leaders of the pro-democracy movement in Sierra Leone. Along with Joe Apala, who we heard from earlier, she co-founded the group The Campaign for Good Governance, which helped organize Sierra Leone's 1996 democratic election. 2 weeks ago, rebel leader Fode Sanko went into hiding as his home was surrounded and ransacked by angry protesters. About 20 of the demonstrators were killed. After several days in hiding, Sanko was captured by pro-government forces and is now in custody. Yesterday, we called Zainab Bangora at her office in Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone. I asked her what the popular opinion is in her country regarding what to do with Fode Sanko, the man who has led the campaign of amputation, rape, and murder, but was made vice president of the country in last year's power-sharing agreement brokered by the U.S., Britain, the U.N., and several African countries.
Well, I think everybody is saying that he should be tried for war crimes, taking into consideration the atrocities that he has committed, but more important, because of the 20 people that were killed in front of his house during the demonstration against him. And also, by trying him internationally, it will give us an opportunity to also try those people who have been involved in the supply of arms and in the sale of diamonds from Sierra Leone. So we call it the war diamonds. It is only through an international tribunal of war crime that we can be able to get our hands on them.
So you think that the amnesty will be ended?
Well, the amnesty only covered the period from the day he started the war and until July 7th when the agreement was signed in 1999. But the amnesty also doesn't apply beyond the borders of Sierra Leone. So if we try him outside Sierra Leone, the amnesty doesn't apply to him. That's what the United Nations said to us. And secondly, I don't think we can afford the cost. But more important, I think Fode Sanko has been a lot of problem to our lives. So we want to put him aside and continue to move ahead with our lives. By trying him in Freetown, it's going to consume our time, it's going to affect our resources, and he's also a security risk.
Is there any functioning government now in Sierra Leone?
Well, it's very difficult, not exactly, because as we all know, that the RUF is controlling over 50% of the country, and the country is sort of disconnected from each other. The South and Eastern Province, even though they are supposed to be under the government control, most of the institutions of governance have not been established. There are no courts operating. The police are just starting to go back before the latest crisis came. So you cannot actually say a functioning government in Sierra Leone. There is a government in Freetown in the city, but the government is here to take control of the rest of the country.
Is there any order in the streets?
Yes, in Freetown there is, because Freetown is well protected by the UN forces as well as by the British. So in Freetown there is some semblance of sanity and security. But beyond Freetown, it's difficult to tell.
Have you been outside of Freetown lately?
Well, you can't because you're not allowed to go there. You know, it's only if either you travel by air to go to other parts of the country that we have UN forces in the south and east, but you definitely cannot travel by road out of Freetown. So I dare not because I'm on the list of wanted people by the RUF, so I will not bother to go out of Freetown.
Now, the RUF terrorized the population of Sierra Leone with mass amputations, rapes, the looting and burning of homes. Is the RUF still terrorizing the people?
They are still, because as I talk to you now, we just got report from Cambia that they are doing massive recruitments. Each and every able-bodied young man is being recruited by the RUF from the Cambia district, from the Putloko district, and they are taking them to Oskailao. They are right now retreating from Bombali district in the northern province, and whilst they retreat, they are burning each and every house on site. So as I speak to you now, there is massive destruction taking place. Nobody can verify these things because nobody is there to come and tell us. The UN forces, the UN human rights people are leaving tomorrow morning to go to Guinea to talk to some of the refugees who are running away from the northern province. So there is a lot of problem going on in the northern province, but there is no government presence or UN presence to verify this. So people who are sneaking in out and coming to us, they are telling us that all the young men are being taken away, the women are being raped. We've not heard of anything about amputation, but we know that the properties, houses have been destroyed and the entire villages and towns have been burned.
Do you have any idea why that was part of their technique for terrorizing the population? Why amputations?
Well, the amputation actually started after the election, or before the election of 1996, which was to force people not to go out and vote, because if you don't have arms, then you can't vote. But when they failed in that, people still went out and voted. They now use that to sort of subject the communities to terror, because they feel that if they cannot control them, they will use terror. And so when they do that, the people are afraid to deal with them. They are afraid to deal with government. They are just totally and completely intimidated by the government. So now, if anybody hears anything about RUF, they run as fast as they can. It is a way of subjecting the entire population to terror and forcing the community to accept them. Because even when the women demonstrated in front of Fodi Sankoh's house on the 6th of May, you know, most of the people who were standing in unfinished buildings around the house demonstrated to the women that they are going to chop up their hands. They're going to cut their throats. It is a way of intimidating the population for you to accept them, to understand that they can do anything they want to do. Nobody can protect you.
Now, is this mostly in the countryside, or did this happen in the city of Freetown, the capital city as well?
It only happened in Freetown after the January 6th invasion. It was done for the past 9 years. It was done out of the capital city, Freetown. But when they came into Freetown and they realized that the ECOMOG were going to drive them out of Freetown, they resorted to amputation, and they ended up amputating over 7,000 people.
In Freetown?
Yes.
An ECOMOG that you just mentioned, that's the West African forces that were sent in.
West African peacekeeping force.
Yeah. So do you see a lot of people in the streets of Freetown now who have had limbs amputated by members of the RUF?
Oh, yes. We have a camp they call the War Victim and Amputative Camp. It's in the west end of Freetown, and there we have about 500 of these people who are there, and we have children as young as 5 months old who were amputated when they were 2 months old. You know, we still have them. We have youngers. The youngest amputee we have at the moment, I think, is about 1 year, 6 months or so. But both of them, a girl and a boy, the boy lost the leg and the girl lost her arm. Both of them were amputated when they were 2 months old.
Now, do you think that the RUF has accomplished its goal of terrorizing people into accepting the RUF, or are people still willing to vote against them if there's another vote?
Well, at least I think to be able to answer that question, I wish you were here on the 8th of May when they demonstrated against Fodi Sankoh, and we had over 100 to 200,000 people who turned out to demonstrate against him. And then when he was captured, Most of the people thought that they should amputate his arms and legs and piece by piece cut him off. But luckily, the police intervened, and also Lieutenant Johnny Paul Koroma insisted that they take him to the police station. People are determined to fight against him, no matter what it costs. They're determined to fight against him. They're determined to prevent him from kidnapping what they have decided that is what they want, and that is democracy. So I don't think any amount of terror can subject the people of Sierra Leone under the RUF rule.
My guest is Zainab Bangura, a leader of the pro-democracy movement in Sierra Leone. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us by phone from Sierra Leone is Zainab Bangura, a leader of her country's pro-democracy movement. Have you or other people who you know who worked on the election in 1996 become disillusioned about the ability of a democratic election to really change the future of Sierra Leone?
Well, we don't look at it that way. We feel that if only we had been given the opportunity to allow our democracy to flourish, we can. Because we feel that our democracy has been sabotaged and manipulated by people who are supposed to be defenders of democracy worldwide and who have forced us to accept the RUF in a government of power sharing, even though these are people who have terrorized us, who have committed some of the worst atrocity. They insisted that we change the constitution to accommodate these people. And these are all things that do not go well for democracy. If only they had supported us in what we were pursuing and trying to rebuild a democratic Sierra Leone, I think we could have been able to achieve more. But rather than that, they forced us to compromise our democracy and in a way which has taken us back to where we did not expect to be. So I think the fact that the democracy did not work in Sierra Leone also was also the contribution of some of the countries outside who have refused to encourage us to do likewise.
You're referring to the peace-sharing plan as being what compromised
the
democracy?
Well, we're referring to the Lomé Agreement. I mean, which took us, I don't want to say 100 years back, but which was completely contrary to the principles of democracy, completely detrimental to the growth of democracy in Sierra Leone. And the fact that we had to bring the RUF in, who do not believe in the principles of democracy, who do not work according to the rules of the game, means that we had to compromise. And by compromising, even the difficult people, the reluctant people who are very reluctant to come along with us, also do not now come to say, what the hell were we fighting for? So I think if we had been left on our own as a country and as a people, we could have achieved much more.
What do you think of Jesse Jackson's visit to Sierra Leone?
To be honest enough, I am not very impressed with him because I was here in Freetown in November of 1998 when he visited, and I remember him making the remark in the United States Embassy when questioned that how is he going to force President Kabah to negotiate with the RUF when the rest of the country do not, or when the population generally do not want him to negotiate. And his remark was that that's what makes a leader. A leader is supposed to mold public opinion. A leader is not supposed to follow public opinion. And I think I found that very insulting because it goes beyond my principle of democracy. And I believe that democracy is for leaders to listen to the opinion of their people, and that is what they follow. It's not for the leader to manipulate that opinion and force the people to accept what they don't accept. So I was not very impressed with that statement, and I have never been impressed, and I find it very insulting that somebody we have so much regard for, that we have read about in the United States, and that we thought should stand there and fight for us as Africans, is here now trying to sabotage and trying to encourage somebody like Fode Sanko to continue to commit some of these atrocities. Because without the encouragement of people like that, I don't think Fode Sanko will have the audacity to come and think that he should lead this country. Because he knows how much we feel about him. He knows how much the people hate him. And he knows how much destruction he's caused for this country. But you cannot explain it to people outside.
The elections failed to create a lasting difference in Sierra Leone. International intervention failed. What is the solution that you would recommend for making things better in the country now?
Well, I think until we're able to deal with the war, with the air wave, we'll never be able to have peace in Sierra Leone. And as I speak to you now, the pro-government forces are right in the heart of the northern province, running after the air wave. You know, I think all the forces, even including their former allies, who have realized now that they made a mistake, that the greatest mistake they made in their life was to join forces with the RUF, have now turned against the RUF, and they are the ones who are running after the RUF. And I hope that if we get them out of the northern province, and then can now follow them to the Diamond area. Because the reason why people like Charles Taylor and the others are supporting the RUF is because they have access to our diamonds. So instead of our diamonds being a blessing to us, they are now being a curse. This is the resources that are being used to kill our people. So we are going to fight the RUF. We're going to fight them to the last day and make sure we get them out of the shores of Sierra Leone so that we can have peace for once. I mean, democracy, I still believe democracy is the way. I still believe in the principles of democracy. And I believe that if only we can be allowed to have a functioning democracy, I think the future for Sierra Leone will be very, very good.
Are you on an RUF hit list? Are you?
Well, if I am in their hit list, well, I know they don't like me. That's much I can say, you know, and that has been said to me several times by the RUF leader himself. So I don't want to say I'm in their hit list, but I know for a fact that RUF do not like educated people. RUF do not like people who voice out opinion against them. RUF do not like people who criticize them. RUF do not like intellectuals. They don't like educated people. Fode Sanko said in one of his interviews that he was going to develop a concentration camp. And this has seen thousands of our educated people leaving the shores of Freetown because they are fighting for their health. So I am not surprised. I know that the RUF, if possible, they can get rid of me if they have the opportunity. And I know they have tried on few occasions. But I'll continue to fight them.
Has it been difficult for you to keep yourself safe?
Well, to some extent, yes, but I have been able to have protection from ECOMOG. So to a large extent, I'm protected inside my house. And so I'm safe as long as I am within the shores of Freetown. That's why I don't take the risk to go out of Freetown.
Where are you talking to us from now?
I'm speaking from my office in Freetown.
And can you see any signs around you of the war?
Oh, I mean, right opposite me, our house was burnt because when the rebel came in January 1996, they actually attacked our office. And because it's a main office that is being used by all the civil society. But luckily for us, it's such a strong building and it's so protected that they couldn't get access into the building. So what they did, they burnt all the buildings around the office. So I don't need to get out of my building to see the level of destruction. And on a daily basis, we have people who come here, amputees. You know, we do a lot of work with the amputee camp, especially in terms of the civic education, and give them airtime on the radio to talk about some of the problems. So, I mean, the evidence of the war is a daily part of my life.
Zainab Bangura, I have one more question for you. I know you're a parent. Can I ask how old your child or children?
My son is 14 years old.
Mm-hmm. Knowing that children have had their arms and legs amputated by the RUF, are there special things you've tried to do as a mother to protect your child?
Well, interestingly, my son actually is joining a human rights group. They have a children's human rights group, and he's visiting the camp. He's collecting old clothing, going to this amputee camp and working with the children. I think he's also getting involved with the kind of job I do, and so he's also started working. He's founded his own small organization with his colleagues between the ages of 13 to 16, and they go into displaced camp and provide charity and food and old clothes for those children. I believe that what I'm doing, I'm doing for my country, and I'm also doing it for my son because I believe that my son deserves to have a better country where he can live. And so as much as I try to protect him, I also try to get him to face the reality of the situation and understand that he has a role to play.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And good luck and stay safe, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Zainab Bangura recorded yesterday by phone from Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone. She's a leader of the pro-democracy movement in her country. Coming up, we speak with Susan Rice, the State Department's Assistant Secretary for African Affairs. This is Fresh Air. Our guests today have been critical of the peace agreement in Sierra Leone. The U.S. was one of the countries that brokered it. Earlier today, we called Susan Rice, Assistant Secretary for African Affairs in the U.S. State Department. The peace agreement gave Fode Sanko a share of the power. It made him vice president, gave him control of the diamond mines. Now, he was the man responsible for, you know, murder, amputations, as well as the burning and looting of homes. Then his men were responsible for kidnapping the UN peacekeepers. In retrospect, do you think it was a mistake to give him a share of the power in Sierra Leone?
Well, the facts are the following. A civil war had been going on for 8 years in Sierra Leone. It was a brutal civil war in which tens of thousands had been killed and maimed. The people of Sierra Leone desperately wanted the opportunity for peace. There was not the capacity within the government of Sierra Leone or even with the regional force, ECOMOG, to defeat the RUF and Fode Sanko. Had that capacity been there, then there would have been no need for a negotiated settlement. But absent that capacity, the government and the people of Sierra Leone, with support from the region, made the decision that a negotiated settlement was the best possible outcome. The United States was present some period of time, about 4 weeks before the negotiations began, and the president's envoy, Jesse Jackson, helped to broker an initial cessation of hostilities. That was a one-day involvement from Reverend Jackson. He left the region, and then a month later, the regional heads of state convened the Lomé peace talks, which resulted in this deal. The United States' interest has been in seeing peace and justice in Sierra Leone. That would have ideally come through a negotiated settlement in which the parties would have upheld their obligations. But obviously, the rebels and Fode Sanko have violated their agreements. They have not upheld their obligations. The prospects for a peaceful settlement along the lines of Lomé are now very much in question.
The point one of our guests makes is that Sierra Leone didn't so much have a civil war as it experienced the breakdown of government. And in the void of government, the terrorism and banditry led by Fode Sanko was able to spread throughout the country. And his point is that the prescription for the breakdown of government is really different than the prescription for civil war. I'm wondering what your reaction to that would be.
Well, I think either way you slice it, and I think there are nuances here that we can all discuss and debate. But the bottom line is that the RUF is a well-armed, well-equipped, well-organized fighting force.
This is the RUF.
The RUF that either needs to be defeated or become, rather than a military force, a political force. That was what the aim of Lomé was, to see if the two sides could fulfill their commitments to end the fighting and compete not through the barrel of a gun but through political means. Now that has not succeeded, the very question remains, is there a military solution?
I wonder what the Clinton administration post-mortem is on this, because Sierra Leone is not the only country in this kind of position. Does it work in a situation where there's this militia that is leading a wave of terrorism? Does it work to give them a share of the power in an attempt to appease them and stop their violence?
The short answer is sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. There have been a number of negotiated agreements, and I'll just focus on Africa to name a few,
mm-hmm.
where a rebel organization has committed to a peace process in which it would play a role in an interim government and commit to elections. That's what was planned and in fact successfully implemented in Mozambique, and now Mozambique is at peace with a democratic government and a very strong opposition led by the former rebel leader. It didn't work in Angola, where Jonas Savimbi, much like Fody Sanko, signed an agreement, upheld it for a period of time, and then violated it. And now Angola is back at war. So the point is, it has worked in some instances, like Mozambique, like Zimbabwe, like Namibia, as they came out of their colonial periods, and it has not succeeded, as it failed in Angola and is clearly in trouble in Sierra Leone. And the question in every instance is there sufficient will among the parties to the conflict, both the government and the rebels, to end the conflict by peaceful means? If that will is not there, then these sorts of agreements are doomed to fail. But one can't judge a priori whether that will is there in the absence of such an agreement.
What are the questions facing the Clinton administration now in terms of how to deal with Sierra Leone?
Well, obviously, our interest is in seeing lasting peace and justice for the people of Sierra Leone. And the question is, how can we work best with the government and the people of Sierra Leone, governments in the region, and others in the international community to try to bring that about? What elements of the Lomé Agreement are still viable and which need to be revised? And, of course, what will the people and the government of Sierra Leone decide to do about Fody Sanko?
Do you think that Fody Sanko can be tried as a war criminal?
That's a decision for the government and the people of Sierra Leone to make. Obviously, he's committed some heinous crimes, and justice needs to be done. But I don't think it's appropriate for the United States to dictate to the people of Sierra Leone how to accomplish that.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Susan Rice is the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Last week, President Clinton announced he had authorized the Department of Defense to provide up to $20 million in defense goods and services to support the efforts of the UN and other international forces to stabilize the situation in Sierra Leone. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing, research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 90th birthday of clarinetist and bandleader Artie Shaw. We'll close with one of the last recordings he made as an instrumentalist. This is Love of My Life, a ballad he wrote with lyricist Johnny Mercer in 1940 for Fred Astaire to sing in the film Second Chorus. This 1954 recording also features Hank Jones at the piano, Tal Farlow guitar, and Joe Roland vibes.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.